hello, and welcome to the Ethos of Aid podcast. My name is Kimber, and I'm your host. Howdy, buddy. That's Creole for how are you? Because today, we are in Sierra Leone. For me, this involves going back in time to my favorite work ever. Yet it also connects many of the themes I've been discussing in solo episodes and with Julius Kwame Tsatsu in recent weeks. Let's dive right in as if we were actually there, diving into some of the clearest, most gorgeous blue waters I have ever swum in. But don't forget, if you're enjoying what you're listening to, please let me know, either at kimbervredenburg.com or at kimbervredenburg on Instagram or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page. I'm going to take you to Sierra Leone today, a beautiful country in West Africa where I worked over 20 years ago, the learning from which lives on in me today. And I'm really just scratching the surface here with this one narrative. There are many more to be shared from this fascinating context to reflect the immense co-created learning that took place as I worked with an exceptional team of individuals during a very challenging time. And as you listen, I would invite you to reflect on the fact that there are many countries in the world today where conflict is happening, where boys and girls like the ones I describe in this narrative are pressed into fighting, where local practitioners such as the ones you'll hear me describing, are themselves impacted by the conflict and working diligently to serve their most vulnerable populations. This is exceptional work, and these are exceptional people. When I arrived in Sierra Leone, West Africa, it was after 12 years of civil conflict, and shortly after the second to last rebel incursion into the capital of Freetown. Freetown, incidentally, is named as such because it was the first ever settlement of freed slaves from the United States who returned to their homeland. As you can imagine, there were a lot of tricky dynamics to work out between those who had been exposed to the horrors of slavery returning home and those who had never left. Those experiences created sociocultural dynamics among the differing groups that live on to this day. We cannot separate ourselves from history and context. You may be more familiar with Sierra Leone because it dominated the headlines when it was severely impacted by the Ebola virus in 2014. What I want to say about Sierra Leone at the start here is that it is populated by the most resilient, gracious, open-hearted people I have ever had the honor of knowing. So as I said, when I arrived, it was shortly after that last rebel incursion, which meant that the rebels from the rural areas were attempting to take the capital, and more populations within the country had been forced to flee their villages, their communities, their homes. They were what the humanitarian community describes as internally displaced, as opposed to refugees, as they're still in their home country. I was first tasked with creating emergency education, recreation, and healing programs for internally displaced children and their families. And then as the country moved towards a time of peace and began a disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration program for former soldiers, both adults and children, the NGO I worked for decided to create programs for the children associated with armed forces and groups. There's a lot to think about here. These children had lived behind enemy lines, participating in violence with their commanders for many years by this point. They considered their commanders and their units their families, which asked us and now asks you to expand your definition of family quite a bit. It has to be considered because even with the level of coercion and violence, these units were all many of the children and youth had ever known, given the young age at which they were either abducted or sent into the fighting forces. These are just some of the many complexities involved in doing this work. Those that are released, and at the time were released, came into the care of NGOs, such as the one I was working with, while their families were being traced. Let's touch on family tracing for just a moment to give you some context. Sierra Leone is a small country in West Africa. The capital city and regional areas with towns of several thousand people, and surrounding these towns are vast swaths of densely treed land, accessed by unpaved roads and footpaths. And over the course of 12 years of civil war, Mother Nature had done her job and reclaimed many of those routes, made them impassable. And there's virtually no signage, either pointing to or within these villages and communities. So the children who left their villages, either voluntarily or through abduction, at very young ages, had virtually no means of identifying them when those doing the family tracing asked questions to try to narrow down where they came from and find their communities and families to send them home to. It's very tricky work. And while their families were being traced, these children needed to be housed, fed, clothed, educated, helped to transition from military to civilian life. Many of them were violent, decorated war heroes with names like Captain Rambo and Lieutenant Blood. And it would be easy to dismiss these as pet names were they not accompanied by the body counts witnessed by those who were present at the time of the atrocities. And who would care for these children and give them all they needed while their families were being traced? And how would that feel to the communities in which their temporary housing was located, wherein children who had not participated in the violence were themselves still living with the impacts of it, in poverty? While the international community wanted very much to support the reintegration of the children associated with armed forces and groups, the local communities who had lived through the war firsthand understandably took exception to the idea of giving these children and youth shoes, while the surrounding community had none. The adjustment to civilian life after such trauma was not easy, and these boys and girls walked the very fine line between being victims and perpetrators. And the rebels had been methodical. They had the children commit atrocities in their own families and communities to sever the ties so they could never go home. Some rebel forces even carved the letters of their factions into the chests of the children so they could be easily identifiable if they tried to escape. So again, who would care for them during this reintegration process? Well, the answer was the very Sierra Leoneans who had been impacted by their violence, the local practitioners we hired, the social workers, community volunteers, tribal elders from Sierra Leone would now be tasked with caring for these children during their transition process. So it was clear to me that there was need to create space for the staff and our program to work through some of their experiences, their traumas from the war, before putting them in the position of caring for the children. Were we to put these children and youth in the care of the Sierra Leonean adults who had experienced their violence without first helping those adults, those local practitioners, work through and process their experiences, we would most assuredly have been putting those children in the path of harm. I often wondered what it would have been like if I hadn't been trained in therapeutic intervention, in trauma-informed practice. While I certainly hadn't been trained to practice on that scale, I discovered very quickly it's not about scale. It's about the individual and group therapeutic relationships. This is what matters in terms of processing and working to serve recipients while also expanding that definition. I considered the national practitioners as recipients of aid in the same vein as the children we were earmarked to serve. So our relationships began there, in the deepest wounds, and they grew through and out of their healing and our collective learning as we speculated how these children who weren't even yet in our care at the beginning of the program might show up. Who would they be? How would they be? How traumatized would they be? This was long before we had the research we have now and the think tanks and university programs dedicated to understanding children associated with armed forces and groups. I can share many extraordinary moments from this context, but the one I want to focus on today really underlines the importance of relationship, trust, the power of a single question, and the opportunities that come when we're willing to look at the beliefs we hold and consider something different. As you heard in my dialogue with Julius Kwame Tsatsu, it's vital that practitioners have the space that we would also give to beneficiaries to process their experiences. There were lots of wins and challenges in this program. We had everything from sudden eruptions of extreme violence to psychological breakthroughs and everything in between. I discovered and frequently tried to impress upon our donors that these youth were just as happy to have a football between their feet as an AK-47 over their shoulders. Most of them really just wanted their lives back and to have the opportunity for what they'd missed. And the movement towards peace at that time, the churches and the mosques that were at the center of the social norms and the beliefs and values in this context were promoting the message, we must forgive. This is a fairly typical practice in a context like this, where these institutions and the religious leaders and cultural leaders who mean so much to the communities are promoting a particular message to move people from war to peace. It's a big task and a big ask, especially in a small country where war had left no one untouched. So I was hearing a lot of this phrase, we must forgive. I heard it on the radio. I heard it in the car during our drives out to communities. And then I would also hear, almost imperceptibly afterwards, but we will never forget. We must forgive, but we will never forget. I really wondered myself, how would it happen after such horrific and pervasive violence? How would it be for one of the staff I was working with to see someone on the street who in pre-war times was their neighbor or cousin or brother, who'd gone to join in the fighting, had returned during the fighting to commit atrocities, and now they'd see them on the street and just forgive? I had no idea how that would happen. But as everything in my work, I saw it as an opportunity for collective learning. And as this work was heavy at times, I quite regularly pulled all the supervisors in together for days of games and activities where we could reflect on what was happening in the program. This was no exception. This was also the context where I learned that laughter is a huge part of Sierra Leonean culture, specifically in processing painful experiences. The first time it happened, where in a group setting, someone shared a very painful story and the rest of the room erupted in laughter, I was in shock. And yet it taught me so much. In Sierra Leone, I experienced laughter in the face of pain as a sanctioned catharsis. It helped people, they said to me. It helped that when they shared painful stories and other people laughed, it gave them permission to lighten the experience. It was extraordinary. And so after we'd had our play and created some new ideas for our programs and let our collective hair down a little bit, I reminded the staff I had been hearing we must forgive, but we never forget for so long. And I told them that as a woman in a white body from Canada who had not lived through 12 years of civil conflict as they had, I did not know how such forgiveness would transpire. I asked the staff to think of someone they needed to forgive, to reflect on the situation, on their relationship and create something to represent it. And then I ask them to reflect on someone in their lives that might still need to forgive them. Maybe someone they hadn't seen in a long time. Who still needed to forgive them? The room went exceptionally still, silent, save for the relentless chirps of birds and bugs outside the window. I let that silence go. I looked around the hot, muggy room and noted one of the staff, looking so far off into the distance. A single tear rolled down his cheek, and I knew not to interrupt his process. Slowly, they picked up their materials and started to create. The only sound in the room was the rustling of pens on paper. Finally, when the materials were laid down, I asked if anyone wanted to share. The first brave being, one of my favorite people in the world still to this day, was the man with the tear. He chose to stand up and said, in a very quiet voice, "This changed everything for me. Before, I would only think of what had been done to me. I only felt blame. I did not know how I would forgive. And now, I feel something. I know there are people from whom I need to ask forgiveness. We have all done things to survive this war, and we have forgotten." That moment remains one of the most powerful moments of my life, one of the most powerful questions I've ever had the honor of asking. All but one of his teammates followed his lead and shared thought after thought, feeling after feeling, realization after realization of the people they needed to forgive and seek out and ask forgiveness from. It was an extraordinary moment of healing from a single question. What came afterwards underlines the extraordinary resilience I described at the top of this podcast. Those staff members went home and shared their new awareness with their families. They took that question to the communities they traveled to, looking for the parents of the children in their care, and they facilitated dialogue about community culpability for the war. And they shared with me that in village after village, people stood up and owned their painful choices during a time of survival. They took responsibility for the people who had been impacted by their choices, asked for forgiveness, and granted it. This was at the heart and start of reconciliation and community-based, internally led reconciliation. It happened long before the formal structures of truth and reconciliation and out of the sightline of the media and the wider community. It started in the heart of villages. It started with those local practitioners the moment they heard the question and chose to reflect and consider changing their perspectives and their beliefs. And in so doing, it also opened the door for communities who had previously been deeply afraid of receiving and reintegrating the former child combatants, to quell their fear, perceive these youth differently, and embrace them with open hearts. This remains my favorite work ever. I can still see it, still feel it today in my mind and heart as if it were yesterday. The best thing I ever hear in my work, in contexts like this one, was said in this context for the very first time. The most engaged of all the staff said to me, "Now we're really learning." And I looked up at him immediately and said, "What are you learning? How do you know?" He said, "We're learning about ourselves in the work. This is the crux of everything I've ever done in humanitarian work. Create space for practitioners to learn about themselves in the work while doing the work. These are the people upon whom everything depends." Well, as I said at the start, there's a lot more where this came from. I have many more narratives to share about this wondrous place, these incredible people, and I'm looking forward to doing so in future episodes. Thanks so much for listening today. I would love to know if you have questions, or if there's anything you're thinking about now that you weren't at the start. I would love to hear from you. Please do so at KimberVredenburg.com or at KimberVredenburg on Instagram or on the Ethos of Aid Facebook page. Till next time.